This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
The Rabble Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Show your support by going to rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
On October 17th, the BC government fired all the elected trustees on the Vancouver School Board for failing to pass a balanced budget. Education Minister Mike Bernier dismissed the board just hours before a meeting where they had indicated they would finally approve the budget. The board said they refused to pass the budget as a symbolic action to highlight ongoing severe cuts to education funding in Vancouver. On November 3rd, SFU's Institute of the Humanities and Ricochet Media organized a public forum to discuss the state of public education in BC following more than a decade of cutbacks. They invited speakers from a broad range of backgrounds to address the effects of the funding shortfall. Last week, we heard from Patty Baucus, one of the Vancouver School Board trustees fired in October. Alex Hemingway works with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. He is author of a recent report that takes issue with the Education Minister's statement that education funding in BC is at record levels. Here's Alex Hemingway.
You know, the situation we're facing in education funding in BC feels eerily familiar to me. I graduated high school in Prince George in 2002, and that was the first big rounds of education cuts over the last 15 years in this province. And you know, at the time, I was in grade 12, and I was in film class, and I decided to make a documentary film about what was happening in the education system. We saw huge numbers of school closures in Prince George at the time, and actually I had a chance to interview the Minister of Advanced Education at the time, because she was a local MLA, and had the chance to challenge the sort of talking points that we heard. As we were seeing cuts on the ground in front of us, we were being told that there were no cuts and that funding was higher than ever. I don't know if that sounds familiar to anybody. anyway, the call, the interview was over the phone. The call ended with the minister hanging up on me. I thought I was being very reasonable about it, but I don't think she was felt the same way. In any case, the echo of that rhetoric that funding is higher than ever is part of what I wanted to talk about today in the time that I have. I think to the casual observer, the education funding situation we've seen in BC just over this past year has been genuinely hard to follow when you do hear again and again that funding is at record levels, and yet on the ground we seem to see something very different. Provincial government claims these high levels of funding and points the finger at local school boards as the culprits for looming school closures and other forms of cutbacks. And you know, this is not just a Vancouver story. Sometimes it's framed that way, but we saw in the spring at least half of the province's school districts were facing budget crises and asked to make these wrenching decisions between closing schools, axing vital programs, and in many cases, those boards were open about the fact that this was a result of chronic underfunding. And of course, the VSB trustees took this to the next step, and in the name of advocating for change of that situation of chronic underfunding, openly defied the province's balanced budget requirement for a time to add extra weight to what they were saying. And you know, I think that that was brave, and that was something that we had asked in Prince George at the time, but unfortunately our trustees weren't quite on board back in 2002. Now, at the same time as we see this underfunding situation, we also see the system continue to rely on parents to fundraise for things as basic as playgrounds and classroom technology. Teachers continue to subsidize the system by paying large out-of-pocket sums for classroom supplies. And I think most concerning of all, what we see on the ground is class sizes having grown and classrooms hosting an increasing number of students with learning challenges and other special needs with too few staff and resources available to support them. Well, one place to start in making sense of all this is to ask, how much have we as a province, as measured by our government's actions, prioritized public education over the past 15 years? Could we afford a major reinvestment in the system if we want? Now, arguably, I think the best way to understand what we can afford when it comes to investment in public education is to look at BC's overall economic pie and see how much of it we invest in the system. And when we do that, when we look at the overall spending level as a share of our economy, what we've seen is a significant drop over the past 15 years from 3.3% of our province's gross domestic product in 2001 down to 2.5% in budget 2016. That's a 25% decline. Now, you can measure this in a number of different ways, and I do in the report, but the result is the same. And these are not small declines. A decline of that scale, about 0.8, 0.9% of GDP dedicated to education, represents about $2 billion a year that could be invested if we simply return to the same levels of investment as 2001 as a share of our economy. Now, we often hear that over this period, enrollment has declined across the province. That's true, although it's on the rise again. So we can also look at these numbers on a per student basis. That's useful as well. And according to the most recent Statistics Canada data, a stat I'm sure many of you have heard, BC has the second lowest per student funding in education in the country, about $1,000 below the national average. In the report, I also corroborate that with a range of other data that you can see, and we could talk about further if you're interested in the Q&A. So how can the government say, then, that funding is at record levels when the reality on the ground seems otherwise and the numbers that I've mentioned to you seem otherwise? Well, in fairness, it is technically true that the raw number of dollars going into the education system in BC has risen. Now, the problem is that's far from a useful metric. For example, I'm spending record levels on groceries, but I'm not eating anymore. We have inflation. The real question is whether spending is keeping up with a few things, the basic inflation rate, first of all, but also, very importantly, a whole range of additional cost pressures that have been downloaded from the provincial government to local school districts. Now, many of these are costs that the government directly controls, including a doubling of MSP premiums since 2001, a 60% increase in BC Hydro rates since 2008. We've seen WorkSafe BC rates go up, the carbon tax, provincially mandated computer network upgrades. So that's all over and above accounting for the basic inflation rate. And of course, when costs are increased and downloaded without enough compensating dollars flowing into our schools, the system is left under enormous pressure. Now, we actually don't know the precise tally of all those cost pressures because there are so many. But there is an internal government document that was released under access to information that quotes one estimate from a few years ago that puts it at least $192 million per year. This was in the 2012 to 2014-15 school years. And, you know, in terms of the contention over the debate about funding levels, one thing often gets missed, that even the legislature's own Standing Committee on Finance and Government Services admits that the funding for public education in BC is inadequate. Now, this is not a partisan committee, it's a backbench committee. The majority of its members are from the governing party, not the opposition. And in its recommendations, the committee simply recognizes this reality, and they say, and I'm just going to quote here, additional funding is necessary to ensure the provision of quality public education and to properly meet the increased costs that schools are facing. It's really hard to escape this reality. And by the way, I would just add that in addition to simply keeping up with cost pressures, we also want to be able to consider new investments to enhance the overall quality of something as immensely important as education. We know that a strong public education system is not just nice to have, it's an essential long-term investment that pays very large social and economic dividends. And we also know from the research that investing resources to reduce class sizes substantially improves outcomes for students and has an equalizing effect by helping disadvantaged students the most. We live in a province with persistent poverty and growing inequality, and education can be one of the great equalizers. We also know, as I mentioned, that kids with special needs and learning challenges are not getting the level of support that they need. Now, knowing that, I think it is critical to understand that there's just no question that BC can afford to reinvest in the system if we choose. You know, right now there happens to be a large budget surplus in the province, but more importantly, as I mentioned, if we dedicated the same share of our overall economic pie to education as we did 15 years ago, we'd have another $2 billion to work with. You're not hearing me wrong, that's billion with a B. Now, that much additional funding may well go beyond what's needed. What it tells us, though, in any case, is that major reinvestment is possible. Now, while we're talking here primarily about education, this, as Samir mentioned, is not only an education story. We've seen this funding decline in public education, but we've also seen provincial public spending on the whole decline as a share of our economy, meaning our public sphere is being shrunk as a share of our economy. And that's not an accident, that's a consequence of specific policy choices that have been taken, including tax cuts that deliver the biggest bang to the richest British Columbians. In fact, households in BC's top 1% now pay an incredible $41,000 less in tax than they did in 2001. Those types of policies undermine our capacity to make the investments we need in areas like education and others, but they are choices. They've always been choices, and they can be changed, and organized, active citizens can have something to say about all that. So thank you.
We've been listening to Alex Hemingway, policy analyst with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, recorded at a public forum on the future of education held November 3rd. The next person to speak at the forum was Diana Day. She is from the Oneida Nation and has lived in Vancouver since 1983. She ran for school board trustee on the COPE slate in 2014. Diana Day began by speaking about her son's experience in public school.
He struggled in school, and being First Nations and just not being able to voice what the actual concerns were, just that he didn't want to go back to that school and he wasn't going to go back, and I couldn't make him. And this happens to many of our youth, and a lot of our youth are experiencing being pushed out of school. And I know that we use the term dropping out a lot, but I always say that they're pushed out and they're not so much dropped out, that they're pushed out. And there's many things that are happening, many systems in place that we have, many policies in place that we have help to discriminate against our people, against First Nations people, and it's something that we shouldn't have happen. And it's 2016. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission and some of the actions that were brought forward were targeting or looking at the population on reserve, and the education system on reserve is different than the education system off reserve. So there's two, federal system and provincial system, that we have to deal with. And many of our kids who, you know, are living in, like in Vancouver, on reserve, but going to school off reserve for high school. There's a lot of discrimination, a lot of racism, a lot of stereotypes that still exist around Aboriginal people, which many people aren't acknowledging. The history, Canada's history of Aboriginal people, the treatment is just horrendous, it's horrible, and it's no wonder you people here were never taught anything in your schools, because it's horrific. And my daughter now, she's going to Langara. She's taking an Aboriginal First Nations anthropology, and she's now learning about some of these the treatments that our people were given. It's something that you know, we often hear, oh, you should get over it. It's happened, you know, so long ago. We hear that, but we're living it. We live it every day. You know, the racism continues, you know, on the buses, on the streets, when you walk through the school doors, from teachers, from other students, you know, the administrators as well, belittling, not taking your concerns serious. Those kinds of things are really, really hurtful to our people. And our people are very proud and very strong. And so, you know, rather than go and put up with that kind of stuff every day, they leave. And they're not going to go back. And that was with my son. He wasn't going back to that place, to that school. And at that time, when he was struggling, that's when the Vision team with Patty Baucus in 2008 and Ken Clement, who was an Indigenous First Nations school board trustee, he was interested in running. And I was a mom with a grade 8 entering the school system. I had a daughter behind him. And I thought, my God. You know, what can we do for our kids? At that time, the graduation rate was 29%. And I was quite shocked because I know, you know, what happens if our people don't graduate and, you know, how we get stuck into cycles of poverty and how difficult that is to break out of and break through. And so I was really, really concerned with my son. And fortunately, he found a culturally safe spot at King George and was able to graduate. Now, that was my main thing, graduating grade 12 and then going on to post-secondary, because from when they were small, I always put that in their mind that that's what they would do, get them to graduate. So he took a math, workplace math, and managed to graduate. Now he wants to go to university, but he can't. And I was so shocked to find out that all along when I was advocating on the school board, I was advocating for our kids to get higher graduation. We need to be getting them graduated. So what I found out was that 5% of that 29% had the prerequisites in order to go on to post-secondary school. Only that. And that really, I was just astounded when I saw that, because I just thought, well, you know, what the hell? Here I am just trying to say we need to do the graduation rates to get them graduated, but we have to do more than that because they're not being tracked, and we need to be able to have a system in place that will support our most vulnerable kids, and those are the First Nations kids, those kids that are in foster care, those kids that aren't being supported by family and by community. We have white privilege as well that we have to acknowledge and realize that people who are white-skinned don't have to worry about being discriminated upon or being treated ill in different places. That you don't have to worry about that. But we do. We have to worry about that all the time. And it's something that doesn't, you have no idea about it. And, you know, it's, I just want to really make this really clear that we have to do something a whole lot better. We're failing our kids. We're failing First Nations kids. And even if it's 42%, you know, that means whatever the number is not graduating. Those people are not graduating. We know what happens when people don't graduate. And we know about the kids in care. They're not graduating. Their rates are really low, too. We have to look out for these kids. The other thing I wanted to mention is the grade 12 students, Aboriginal students, reported that they were 5 times more likely to be bullied than non-Aboriginal in grade 12. So can you imagine, you're an Aboriginal person, you're in grade 12, you finally get to grade 12, and then you're 5 times more likely to be bullied? And we need to educate everyone. We need to educate mainstream about First Nations people, to be able to have education, the curriculum, adaptable to each grade level so that there can be something at each grade level. Not that students have to wait until they get to college or university in order to learn about their people and about the history that needs to be taught at each grade level. Because we need a lot of allies. There's a lot of things that are happening we need allies not only in education but in a lot of other areas as well.
And we've been listening to Diana Day, First Nations advocate and a school board candidate for COPE in 2014. And this is Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, and you're listening to Red Eye. Follow us on Twitter to get quick updates. Our handle on Twitter is at Red Eye Radio. We're focusing on the future of public education today on Red Eye. We're bringing you a number of speakers recorded at a public forum sponsored by SFU's Institute of the Humanities and Ricochet Media on November 3rd. The forum was organized in response to the province's firing of the Vancouver School Board on October 17th. Maggie Milne-Martins is a co-founder of the Parent Action Network for Community Education. She also addresses the lack of funding and talks about what it means for parents who have to fundraise to pay for some of the basic necessities of school life. We join her talk as she lists all the things that are no longer provided by the school districts.
I want to read you a sampling from a recent survey that we did in September, including data from 33 Vancouver schools and 10 schools in 10 other districts across the province, who identified items that they have funded in the last couple of years in their schools. And I'm only citing the items that were either very consistent, high frequency, or across all responses. So here it goes. All technology, iPads, sound systems, printers, software, resource supplies, sensory materials and equipment for special needs children, art materials, musical instruments, classroom books, library books, graded readers, all PE supplies, including basics like mats, balls, and cones, curtains, furniture, including student desks, cafeteria tables, and chairs, gym risers, playgrounds, PE instruction, music instruction, art instruction, sexual education instruction, cultural performances at schools, all enrichment activities and field trips, and some schools are even paying for TOCs. All this is part of the trade-offs that parents and good stewards should be willing to accept. So we know that while some PACs can raise money to provide some of these resources, and some families have the means to outsource lost educational services, such as special needs assessment, arts programming, special needs and learning supports, others cannot. And this is particularly true for the 22% of children in the city who live in poverty, for whom even the basic school supply fee is prohibitive. So these children are being denied, by virtue of their socioeconomic status, their basic educational rights. So what trade-offs are we willing to make as good stewards? Are we willing to brand our schools with corporations? Are we willing to eliminate recess and Friday instruction, as one school district in Comox has had to do? Or are we willing to go through mass school closure in order to reduce our shortfall, keeping in mind that given the minimal savings, Vancouver would have to close over 30 schools in order to make up the predicted shortfall for this coming fiscal year? But it's not only the minimal savings, it is also that the schools in areas of highest poverty, schools with higher populations of Aboriginal children and new immigrants, whose families are most reliant on neighborhood services and supports, that are most likely to be in under-enrolled schools, and therefore most likely to be in seismically unsafe schools, and are most likely to have their schools closed as inefficiencies. So these are the hard choices, the difficult decisions that good stewards are being called to make. There is another word for this kind of choice, and that is discrimination. Parents are no longer willing to accept these kinds of trade-offs that are creating such gross inequalities within our public system, and by extension, our whole society. Willful and unrestrained underfunding by government, in contravention of its own legal mandate and the declared priorities of its own citizens, is undermining the very democratic principles that our public education system is founded on. We absolutely need to demand that government commit to restoring democratic and representative governance within the VSB by setting a by-election date. But we also need to recognize that this is a symptom of a much bigger problem. We need to recognize that our public education system is actually the holder of our democratic values of our society, and that if we value our democracy, we must fight to retain it. As teachers and staff are doing this every day by still being committed to providing excellence in education in the face of lost resources and increasing needs. And as citizens and as parents and as grandparents, we need to do our part. We need to stop the erosion of our public education system. We need to demand adequate, predictable, and sustainable funding to meet the learning needs of all children without discrimination, because this is the meaning of democracy.
We've been listening to Maggie Milne-Martins, co-founder of the Parent Action Network for Community Education. She was speaking at a public forum on the future of education held November 3rd. When the provincial government fired the Vancouver School Board on October 17th, one elected trustee was not fired. Isabella Preeti is a grade 12 student at Kitsilano Secondary School. She is serving as the student trustee representative of the Vancouver District's Student Council. In this segment, Isabella describes how the funding cutbacks have affected the new grade 8 students who started at Kitsilano this fall.
I also wanted to give an experience that I faced at my own school at Kitsilano Secondary this year to provide some context as to what's happening in our school, for instance. So at the beginning of this year, we had a boatload of fresh-faced grade 8s, if you will, come into our school, and we always hear the problems with class sizes, for instance. We typically hear that classes should have 25 to 30 kids, and many of the social studies teachers had 35. Take that in for a second, 35 children. So with that, the teachers were not able to properly address the needs of each individual student. The amount of desks needed to fit into our new classrooms, which we're so grateful for, would not fit simply in these rooms. It was completely packed with students. So a month into the school year, the grade 8s had to be completely transformed into different classrooms, and they had to redo completely the timetables for these grade 8 classes because teachers could not handle the amount of kids that were in their classes. And we had to find a way to solve this problem because students were feeling as though they were not learning in the best possible way because the teacher was addressing too many students at once, and they weren't able to ask questions because we're constantly running out of time. I face it in my own classes. I have a question to ask about what happened in the reformation, and they say, we don't have time, we have to keep going with the content because there's so many questions to be asked. And this is not something that is just seen at my school. I have heard similar stories from students at Tupper, from Killarney, etc. And the big message I'm trying to share here is, no matter what has happened over the past few weeks, I will continue to advocate for students and ensuring that our role is respected, because many of us do have a voice next year, and all these decisions that are being made surrounding education, public ed, just general politics of BC, grade 12 students, many of them can actually affect the way that this election is going to go. And it's an exciting thought, but it's also a bit nerve-wracking, because seeing as the vote that was given to these trustees was pretty much dismissed, how is our vote going to be affected potentially next year? All I would like to just leave you with for just food for thought, I suppose, is continue to advocate for your students and for your BC kids, because no matter what, I've seen so many alumni come back, and often there's the phrase, you know, you'll hear from people saying, well, once you graduate, you don't really care anymore, right? But that's not true. I mean, you might have, students themselves might have kids one day going into the system, and every year the problem is the same. There's no amelioration, it would seem. It seems every year we're getting more and more deficits, more and more cuts, and every year we have to make decisions that are affecting our community as a whole. And with that, it's important that you continue to advocate, and no matter what decisions have been made on this formality level, that we have these tools, and we are lucky to have tools such as social media, such as these kinds of forums, so that people like you and students can come and show their solidarity for their basic right to education. And to end off, it's important that we as a community understand that education is one of the best investments we will ever make. No matter what happens over the course of the next couple of months leading up to the election, it's important that we as a community, myself representing students, show that public education is something that should always exist and be accessible to everybody. It's not fair that some students would not have the right to have the same programs or be prepared as equally for the rest of their lives as someone in a private education. We continue to focus on leadership as Vancouver District Student Council, and we will completely continue to do so. No matter what has happened, I will continue in my role and spread student voice. That is no question whatsoever.
We've been listening to Isabella Preeti, a grade 12 student at Kitsilano Secondary School. She is serving as the student trustee representative of the Vancouver District Students Council. She is currently the only elected trustee on the Vancouver School Board, following the province's dismissal of the board last month.